I want to pick up where we left off in the Gospel of Mark. We left off in chapter 8. Gospel of Mark, I believe there's 16 chapters in Mark, so we're about halfway through this. Beginning with verse 1, it says, In those days again, when there was a great multitude and they had nothing to eat, he summoned his disciples and said to them, I feel compassion for the multitudes because they have remained with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away fasting to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them will have come from a great distance. And his disciples answered him, Where will anyone be able to find enough to satisfy these men with bread here in the wilderness? And he was asking them, How many loaves do you have? And they said, 7. And he directed a multitude to sit down on the ground, and taking 7 loaves, he gave thanks and broke them and began giving them to his disciples to serve them, and they served them to the multitudes. And they also had a few small fish. And after he had blessed them, he ordered these to be served as well. And they ate and were satisfied, and they picked up 7 full baskets of what was left over of the broken pieces, and about 4,000 were there, and he sent them away. Now, this is the second miracle that Christ has done that in regards to feeding the multitude miraculously. I think some critics of the Bible have said, well, this is a contradiction, because before it was 5,000 people, before it was 5,000, here it's 4,000, and so on and so forth. But if you read the context, it was two distinct, separate miracles that were performed. The first feeding, Jesus fed the 5,000 men, so that there's a good indication there that if they just counted the men, then of course there was a lot of women and children as well, so there's probably a lot more than 5,000. And in that particular incident, which is recorded in all four Gospels, Jesus, he had 2 fish and he had 5 loaves of bread, and he had ended up with 12 baskets full left over after he fed the 5,000. And here, he's got 7 loaves of bread, which are just probably small biscuits, like when he's talking about loaves of bread. And he also had a few fish, and he fed 4,000, and he got 7 baskets left over. But I think, in dealing with this, we got to see the spiritual implication of it, because this is emphasized by the Holy Spirit in every gospel for a very specific reason. Because here's the situation. We always have a tendency, and I'll put my own name on the top of the list, to look at a situation and say, man, how are we going to do this? Just like what Kevin was sharing tonight. It's all the stuff's going through my head. Well, man, how are we going to do this? How, you know, and my mind is scrambling. How am I going to come up with the money for this? And I have to just settle down in my spirit and say, well, look, you know, it was Hudson Taylor who said something to the effect that God's work done in God's way will not lack God's provision. Now, here's a situation where their human resources are absolutely, totally inadequate to meet this tremendous need. There's just no way. It's impossible. But Jesus asked anyway, what do you have on hand? What do you have to work with? Give me whatever you've got. This is the same message that Jesus says to all of us. Hey, whatever you have, just give it to me and let me handle it. But that's what it takes. We have to give him what little bit that we have, you see, in order for him to work with it, to work through it. That's one of the compelling messages of this feeding of the 5,000 people. Because before I go any further on this story, let's just read a little bit further, because I think we'll get a bigger picture of what transpires in this miracle. Because the apostles just don't get it. And I put myself in the same category as them, that I would have just as much of a hardened heart, or just as much of a dull mind when it comes to getting the message. And what I mean by that, let's just pick up a little bit further of what happens after this episode, because it says here, pick up verse 9, and about 4,000 were there, and he sent them away. And immediately he entered the boat with his disciples and came to the district of Dalmanuta. And the Pharisees came out again and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And sighing deeply in his spirit, he said, Why does this generation seek for a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation. And leaving them, he again embarked and went away on the other side. And they had forgotten to take bread, and did not have more than 1 loaf in the boat with them. And he was giving orders to them, saying, Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began to discuss with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet see or understand? Do you have a hardened heart? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many large baskets full of broken pieces you picked up?" And they said to him, 12. "And then I broke the 7 for the 4,000 and how many baskets full of broken pieces did you pick up?" And they said to him, 7. And he was saying to them, "Do you not yet understand?" Now, the reason I went this far is because here's the situation that it's easy for us to sit in a comfortable living room 2,000 years later and kind of be armchair quarterbacks and go, "Hey, what's wrong with these guys? They done can't get it through the thick skull." But hey, I'm telling you, this is the situation where Jesus finds pretty frustrating in a sense that he performed this tremendous miracle in meeting enormous need on such little resources. All he wanted was, "Hey, just give me what you have and let me take it from here." Okay, and he fed the 5,000. Here he feeds the 4,000, and yet the disciples get in the boat, and they forgot to bring bread. So when Jesus, having confronted the Pharisees, who are so hostile towards him, he makes mention of the fact that, hey, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod. And they're thinking, leaven? Well, he's talking about bread. Oh, man, we forgot to bring the bread. What are we going to do? We got no bread. And Jesus, you can kind of sense his frustration, his exasperation. Like, hey, don't you have a clue? First of all, I'm not talking about bread. You're worried about bread. I mean, can't you get it? I mean, did you see? He asked him something like almost 9 different questions, rhetorical questions. Hey, man, you know, he's basically saying, didn't I feed the 5,000 with how many loaves of bread? How many fish? Didn't I feed 4,000? So in other words, hey, I'm not talking about bread, but even if the issue were bread, you know, why are you worried about it? In other words, hey, I'm here. I'm going to provide. How many times have you run into situations where you really got to depend upon God? I don't care whether it's finances or you name it. And then, you know, through prayer, God comes through. Your prayers are answered. But then something else down the line happens. And then you're all upset. You're all worried. You're all anxious. Like, okay, now what are we going to do now? For example, how many retreats have we put on over the years? I mean, every year we're putting on these retreats for the least, the last, and the lost. And I got to struggle with finances because, you know, these things are pretty expensive, and virtually everybody that comes up there is sponsored. And they're mainly sponsored by people on the board. I mean, you know, we have no fundraising activities or anything like that. We're just completely dependent upon God. Well, long story short, I'm confronted with this situation every year. And I have to always say, hey, look back on the past and say, okay, God has always come through. God has always provided. Even though we had, you know, it didn't seem like we'd ever make ends meet, he always came through and he always provided, because I always, you know, keep that in the back of my mind. If I just do it God's way and in God's will, then he'll take care of the rest. Same thing with Jesus is trying to get through to his apostles. They're worried about bread. We don't have enough bread. What are we going to do? And he's like, man, you know, the bread isn't the issue here. He wasn't even talking about that. He was talking about the corruption of the Pharisees and the corruption of the politicians of the day. That's what he was talking about. But these guys are worried about the bread. He said, hey, forget the bread. I mean, you know, can't you get it through your head? I will take care of that. I will take care of the needs. If we just are willing to give what little bit that we have, that's, I think, one of the most important principles in these stories. Just give him what we've got. How many times have I said, God doesn't look at our limitations. He doesn't look at our meager resources. All he wants is that if we give him what we have, that he will magnify it, amplify it. He will meet the need at the time. Jesus gave the parable of the talents. He gave the parable of the coins. And he gave all of these illustrations to emphasize to us, I think, some very serious things. You know, remember the talents, when he talked about the parables of talents, where he said one guy was given one talent, one guy was given 5, one guy was given 10. The guy who was at 5 and 10 had doubled theirs. But the guy with the one talent, he went and buried his, came back, said, well, here's your talent back. And Jesus said this was a worthless, good-for-nothing servant or slave, you know, who could have at least taken that talent and put it in the bank so that it could have drawn interest. We all remember the story. Well, I've said this over and over again, and I'm so convinced of it, that if every person who professes to believe in Christ, every one talented person, okay, I consider myself to be one talented person. You know, I'm not a Billy Graham. You know, I'm not a Chuck Swindoll. I'm not a James Dobson. You know, these guys are light years beyond my ability to do anything. You know, and I don't say that with any false sense of humility. That's just the truth. God has given them 5 or 10 talents. He's given me one. He's given everybody in this room at least one. But how many people have been given one talent? And we've all been given at least one. If they don't use that talent, if they bury the talent, what's going to happen to them? And what's going to happen to us if we do that? But at the same token, the other side of the token is every person who God has given one talent to would just surrender their talent to God, and they would utilize that one talent for His glory, for His honor. I'm convinced this world could be turned on its ear overnight. This world could be turned upside down overnight. But the world isn't going to be changed, I don't believe, by the 5 and 10 talented people. I don't believe it. Because it would have been by now, don't you think? It really would have been. It's going to require the millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of people who have been given one talent, who are doing nothing with their one talent, but sitting on it. You know, interesting, Jesus gave this parable in two different ways, two different times, and two different analogies. In one time, he says that the individual with the one talent took his talent and buried it in the ground. The other, in another parable, he said a guy took his one talent and hid it in a handkerchief. And to me, that's very symbolic and very significant, because the person with the one talent hid it in the ground represents using his talents all the wrong ways, in the world, in places that are mucky and dirty and so on and so forth, and just, he's buried his talent in a way that's just simply buried in the world. The lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, pride of life, whatever. The other person, he keeps his in a handkerchief. He's the religious person, okay? He's nice and clean. He's the person that has the attitude of, oh, I don't dance, and I don't smoke, and I don't drink, and I don't chew, and I don't associate with those that do, and I don't, you know, watch TV or go to movies. And, you know, when I think of people like that, I say, so what? So what? I mean, neither does a cockroach, neither does a cow. I mean, what does it make you? What kind of religion is that? I would say this. I'm convinced of it. God would rather have a person smoking a pack of cigarettes a day who's determined to follow Him with their whole heart, mind, and soul, and strength, than a person say, oh, I don't smoke, man, I don't chew, man, and this guy beneath me, you know, and doesn't do anything for the glory of God, doesn't pursue God with any kind of reckless abandon, doesn't use his talent. Who do you think is more pleasing to God? You know what I'm saying? I say, hey, smoke your cigarettes, but what are you doing for God? I don't care. God will deal with that in due time if He wants you to quit. To me, it's not an issue. People want to bury their talent in a handkerchief. It's like, these people aren't going to have a lot to account for because they're not using that one talent. They're not giving it to God and saying, okay, this is all I've got. It's nothing to meet the enormous need that's around me, but hey, I'll give it to you. And, you know, He will bless it. He will use it for His glory, for His honor. I think this is one of the main purposes of this miracle and of this recorded story for us is just so as, hey, God just wants us to give Him what little bit that we have and to trust Him to multiply it for His glory and for His honor for the needs that are around us. You know, that's the whole, I think, emphasis of this story. But just backing up with the situation with the Pharisees during this story, because you go back to verse 11, it says, and the Pharisees came out and began to argue with Him, seeking from Him a sign from heaven to test Him. And sighing deeply in his spirit, he says, why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation. And leaving them, he again embarked and went away on the other side. You know, this is really insightful too, because here's the Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees and all the rest of them. These are self-righteous spiritual leaders. But they're not going out to seek Jesus to say, hey, man, you know, this guy, obviously God's with this guy. I want to know more about what he has to say. No, it's like, hey, don't confuse me with the facts. My mind is made up. We are going to put this guy in his place. And like, so regardless of what Jesus would say to them, regardless of what he would do, they have already decided, hey, we want nothing to do with this guy. Motivated by their jealousy, by their envy, by their resentment, by whatever it is that was their motivation for the hostility towards him. They were always trying to test him, always trying to put him on the spot, always trying to trip him up. And they come up to him again, and look what they say. They say, give us a sign from heaven. Now, this is interesting to me. It's pretty insightful. What is Jesus' response? To me, it shows his real humanness, because he goes like this. You ever see a person do that? I mean, it says he takes a deep sigh. In other words, he just inhales real deeply and exhales like, oh, gosh. You know what I mean? You just see his exasperation. I mean, you just feel it. I can sense it here just reading it. Can't you? And Jesus, think of it now. He's just performing all these miracles. I mean, everything from raising the dead to feeding multitudes of people with virtually nothing but crumbs. And he's doing all these different things. And these people come and say, hey, we want a sign. I mean, would that make you sigh and go, man, what do you guys want? You know what I mean? And so I think some of the commentaries that I read, that the Jewish people at that particular time, the leaders or the scribes or Pharisees or whatever, they felt like when the Messiah comes, you know, there will be great signs in the sky. Well, they were always confusing Christ's second coming with his first coming when they would read some of what the prophets would say. And so they asked for some big sign. I don't know, they want the sun to dance in the sky or whatever. And Jesus is not going to give that. And as a matter of fact, if you read the account in Luke, and if you read the account in Mark, I mean, and Matthew, it goes even further. Mark just tells us here that Jesus said, you're not going to be given a sign. But in the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus says, no sign is going to be given to this generation but the sign of Jonah. He said that Jonah was in the belly for 3 days and three nights, and so the Son of Man shall be in the belly of the earth for 3 days and three nights. The sign of Jonah was the sign of his resurrection. That was the sign that he was going to give them, that he was the Messiah. But these guys wanted something dramatic. But at the same token, it was Jesus who knew, hey, if you don't believe me now, and everything that I'm teaching and saying and backing up with all these miracles, it doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't matter what kind of sign I give you. I can have the sun and the moon dance together out there, and it's not going to change you. You're going to say it was from Beelzebub. You're going to say it was from the devil. You're going to say it was a sleight of hand because the people's minds were already made up. If you stop and think about it, go back all the way back to the 18th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. God told Moses, he says, I'm going to raise up a prophet like you, Moses. And he says, and, you know, let me back up a little bit. When God was on the mountain, he called up Moses to the mountain. He told all the people to gather around the mountain. But if anybody even so much as touched the mountain, they were to be executed. They were to be put to death. And on the mountains, all on fire. And the whole place is just shaken. And there's a trumpet sounding and, you know, the voice of God. And everybody's terrified. All these people around this mountain, and they're all shaken. And their knees are knocking together. And Moses, even Moses was terrified at this tremendous sight. But Moses goes up this mountain, okay, and before he starts up the mountain, the people are saying, hey, you go up there, man. You go up and you find out what God wants to say, but we're going to stay down here, man. We're not getting close to this God, okay? So Moses goes up there. Moses is a type of Christ. He goes up to the mountain, and then he comes back and tells everybody what God said. But see, what God told them is, okay, we don't want God to speak to us, lest we die. So God told Moses, okay, I'm going to raise up a prophet like you, Moses. And he told him, he says, if they don't listen to you, this prophet, maybe I'll just read it rather than it says in Deuteronomy 18, it says, I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. That's what God told Moses about the coming of Christ, that I'm going to raise up somebody like you, and I'm going to require anybody who doesn't listen to him, they're going to have to answer to me. This is God talking. So here you see Jesus, and you see his exasperation with these people. They wouldn't listen to Jesus. Now they're going to have to answer to God. And, you know, these people, obviously, if they didn't turn to Jesus, you know where they're at tonight. Because they refused to listen to this prophet that was foretold that would come, and that prophet was Jesus. Anyway, let's pick up where we left off in verse 22. And they came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to him, and they entreated him to touch him. And taking the blind man by the hand, he brought him out of the village, and after spitting on his eyes and laying his hands upon him, he said to him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see men, for I am seeing them like trees walking about." Then again he laid his hands upon his eyes, and he looked intently, and it was restored, and began to see everything clearly. And he went to his home saying, "Do not even enter the village." Now, here's an interesting thing. I just have thought about this a lot over the years, but you look at the situation and you wonder, why in the world does Jesus do something like this? Let's read it again and put yourself in this situation and put yourself in a blind man's condition. All right, get the feel of it. Verse 22, and they came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to him and entreated him to touch him. And taking the blind man by the hand, he brought him out of the village. And after spitting on his eyes and laying his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see men, for I am seeing them like trees walking about." Then again he laid his hands upon his eyes, and he looked intently, and was restored, and began to see everything clearly. Now here's a few things that you wonder. Why in the world is he spitting his eyes? We read a couple chapters previous to this, when Jesus healed a dumb man, he spit on his tongue. And we read in the ninth chapter of the Gospel of John, where there's a blind man, and Jesus spits on the ground and makes a little bit of clay with his spittle, and he puts it on a man's eyes, and he says, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam." And on the way to wash in the pool of Siloam, his eyesight is restored. Here he's healing these different people. And there was another guy by the name of Bartimaeus who was by the roadside, and he was screaming out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus, I want to see." And Jesus just said the word and healed him. See, you have different episodes of Jesus healing blind people, and he does it different ways with different people. That's why I always say that if anybody says to me, "Hey, God doesn't work that way. That's not the way God does things." I always say, "Hey, don't put God in a little test tube and don't dissect him in the classroom, because he's sovereign. He's going to do what he does, the way he does it, the way he wants to do it, and nobody can say otherwise." I know there's people running around today say, "Hey, if you don't do things our way, you're not part of the true church." I just try to ignore these people, because I say, "Hey, God's not limited by this." And you go back to this situation with this blind man, and I'm looking at the situation, I'm saying, okay, a few things that he did. He takes the blind man out of the village. Now, I think it, human nature, if we had the power to heal, I think it would just be a tendency to want to do what?
Do it in front of crowds.
Yeah, do it in front of crowds. "Hey, what's the power I got? You know, be healed," right? No, Jesus takes him away from the crowd, out of the city, by himself. And I think that's very instructive. Because Jesus shows a real personableness here. He's treating everybody differently, everybody as individuals. You know, he doesn't just save in mass. He doesn't answer our prayers in mass. He doesn't deal with us in mass. He deals with us on one-on-one, and he meets us where our needs are. But here's the situation. Okay, stop and think. Now, this is speculative on my part, but I want you guys thinking. Jesus takes this guy out, and he spits in his eyes. Any clue as to why he would do that? Because all we had to do was just speak the word. Now, keep a couple things in mind. You go back into Leviticus chapter 15, 8. God said that if a man who had his discharge, if a man was sick and he spit on another man, the man who got spittle on him, he would be defiled for the whole day. He'd have to wash and clean and wash his clothes and so on and so forth. That's recorded in Leviticus 15. And in Numbers 12, we read a situation where Miriam, if you remember that, Miriam and Aaron, they got in a big confrontation with Moses, because Moses married this Cushite woman who was believed to be a black woman. And they were arguing with him over that. And God appeared to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. And God said, "You three, come up to the tent of meeting. Come up here right now." So they come up to the tent of meeting. And God's there. And he addresses Aaron and Miriam and says, "Hey, whenever I speak to a man, I've always done it through dreams or through visions or through other means." He says, "Not with Moses, my servant." I says, "I speak to him mouth to mouth or face to face." He says, "You two should have kept your mouth shut. You two are way out of line." And so when God started to depart, Miriam was struck with leprosy. And Aaron panicked. He says, "Oh man, what's happened?" And he tells Moses, says, "Oh man, forgive us of the sin and don't let her be like a dead person." And Moses goes running after God saying, "Oh God, please heal my sister." And God said, "Hey, if her father spit in her face, she would be defiled for 7 days. That's in Numbers chapter 12. Okay? You get the situation? And in Deuteronomy 25, verse 9, there's a situation where if a person was If a man failed to build up his deceased brother's house, his deceased brother's wife was to publicly spit in his brother's face as a form of insult. So here you got a situation where spitting on someone would make them unclean. It was a form of an insult, right? It was a form of defilement. Jesus, in a previous miracle that we read, I think in a couple of chapter 6, he spit on a man's tongue who was dumb, who couldn't speak, to get him to speak. Here, he spits in the guy's eyes. Now, what's Jesus doing? Now, this is speculative. He leads the guy out, and it's my conviction of this. The guy himself probably doesn't have a whole lot of faith. What does Jesus do? He spits in his eyes. Now, stop and think about it. Put yourself in this guy's position. What would be your reaction if somebody spit in your face?
I'd be kind of mad.
Okay. I think Jesus is testing the man. I don't think his saliva has anything to do with the healing of the man. The guy, Jesus is testing the man. Are you going to trust me? That's what he's saying. Are you going to trust me in this? Rather than the guy becoming indignant, like, well, you just spit on me? What's wrong with you? Right? The guy had to trust Jesus. He had to put his faith in him, right? Our natural reaction would be recoil at something like that. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? Instead, Jesus spits in his eyes, and then he asks the guy, can you see? Well, the guy, obviously he's putting his trust in Jesus, but he doesn't have a full trust in him because he says, I see men, they're walking around like trees. So Jesus takes a little step further, lays hands on him, speaks over him, prays over him, and the guy can see clearly. My contention is this. How many of us, I take my own wife as an example, she's going through some very difficult times right now as far as her physical infirmity. And she's, confided in me, why is God doing this to me? Why is God doing this to me? From our perspective, he may be spitting in her face, but he's really not doing that. What is he doing? He's testing her faith. He's testing my faith. He's testing us in this situation. Are you going to trust me in this? You're going to put your confidence in me in this. So how many times does God, when he wants to perform a miracle in our life or wants to open our spiritual eyes, bring us through some very difficult times, maybe some very humiliating times, right? And for us to learn some very profound spiritual lessons. How many times have we experienced it? I mean, I don't know how many times I've experienced in my life where I feel like I've asked Jesus for a loaf of bread, he's given me a stone. I've asked him for a fish, he's given me a serpent. Sometimes I feel like this, but I have to trust him in what's going on in my life. And right now, going through a very difficult thing with my wife's infirmity, and we have to trust him. In a way, in a sense, he's spitting in our face. Not to out of insulting, not to defile us, not to humiliate us, but are we going to trust him in this very humbling and difficult situation? Are we going to put our trust in him? And you notice the progression here? The guy couldn't see clearly immediately, but he began to see in a state of progression. So his healing was progressive. It wasn't instantaneous. But through the progression, there was something to be learned through this. I know that Debbie's sister is going through a very, very difficult time, and we need to continue to pray for her. But one thing that happens when sometimes we go through some very, very difficult, trying times is that we can become resentful to God. Like, what are you doing spitting in my face? You know what I mean? Rather than, I got to trust this guy. Regardless of what he's doing, it doesn't make sense to me, and I just feel humiliated in him doing this to me, but I'm going to trust him rather than lash out, become angry with God or angry with those around us, right? Because that's what the devil is going to motivate us to do. We have to trust him. And the healing may be progressive. It doesn't have to be instantaneous. You see the situation?
That's what he did to Miriam, though. Was that a punishment?
Yes, that was a punishment because God said if her father spit in her face, she would be defiled for 7 days. So she had leprosy. They had to put her outside the camp for 7 days. After 7 days, she was healed of her leprosy, and then she was able to be brought back into the camp. But if they were to go through the protocol that was set forth in the book of Moses, she would have to have cut off all her hair and her eyebrows, all her hair of her body, and she would have to be washed and so on and so forth, go through all this cleansing ceremony in order to be accepted back into the camp. So it was really humiliating because of her sin.
How do you know when God does something like that? I mean, because you hear today, for example, what's happening to me, you'd be thinking, well, did I do something? Is it a punishment? And everybody says, no, God doesn't work that way. He's not punishing you.
Well, okay.
But he did that to Miriam.
Every situation is different, and you take that in the context of what was going on there. How many times did God do things in the Old Testament, you know, that he doesn't do in the New Testament? It was to instill in his people spiritual insight, understanding. See, these people didn't have the whole word the way that we do. So back then, they had everything from their Levitical laws of what they could eat, what they couldn't eat, what they could drink, what they couldn't drink, all these different things. We're no longer, you know, under that. But when God would punish a person for a specific purpose, it was done for our what? For our instruction, for our Paul tells us in Timothy, for our understanding, our instruction, our example, our edification, just the way God would teach us. All right. I mean, when a person is struck by cancer or an infirmity, or you know, especially like a little child, we always have that tendency. Remember the guy who was born blind? They said, who sinned? Was it him or his parents? I mean, we're always looking for somebody to blame for this. And Jesus said, no, neither one of them. Maybe, you know, this is done for the glory and honor of God. We can't let the devil be beaten on and say, well, he's done this to you because what? What did you do? I mean, me, this is a different story, but I don't know what you did. You know, yeah, we're always looking for, is this a punishment? No, I don't think it's a punishment at all. I think what it is where Jesus said, in the book of Isaiah, it says, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. It's a matter of when, it's not a matter of if. We're all going to have to pass through the waters. These waters of difficulties and trials and tribulations and setbacks and disappointments and heartbreaks and disillusionments, everything that we have to go through, this is passing through the water. What happens when we pass through the water? When we cling to Him, we grow in our faith. Stop and think for a minute, okay? What do you think the world would be like? What do you think we would be like if God just rained down every day dollar bills from heaven like manna and say, here, have a good time. Here, right. And we all had perfect health. Look what happened to the people of Israel. When God provided for them with the bread of angels every day, they would go out there, except on Sabbath, and they would collect this manna, right? Imagine it being dollar bills, but they're out there collecting this bread, right? And God's providing for them. What happened to them? After a while, they got sick and tired of it. They came complaining and moaning and groaning to Moses, and we're sick and tired of this and sipping manna. We want meat to eat, and we're fed up with it. We want to go back to Egypt. You see what I'm saying? They became ungrateful pigs, and they angered God so much. He said, you want meat? I'll give you meat. I'll give you so much meat, you'll vomit it out your nose. And remember what happened? He brought these quail in, and people were out there banging them around with their sticks or their bats or whatever. They, you know, they were having a grand old time killing all these quail. They said the least of them had laid out all these dead quail. Look at all the quail I got. You know, it's like nobody in the world could eat all this quail, but they had it all, and they were very proud of it. Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, pride of life. And they got sick on it because they didn't appreciate what God gave them. They didn't appreciate Him at all. They said, oh, we're sick and tired of this. So this is the way we are, you know. I hate to say it, I hate to admit it, man, but this is the way we are by nature. God, He's nobody's fool. He knows how to deal with this, to get us to appreciate things, to get us to see things for what they are. And a lot of times He has to put us through some very trying, difficult things so that we can appreciate what we have. Doesn't that make sense to you? Yeah.
Maybe punishment isn't the correct word, but the New Testament is full of passages that, you know, don't think lightly of the discipline of the Lord, and
right,
that He, just like an earthly father disciplines his child, He's going
right
to discipline us.
Right.
Not
those
to,
who He loves.
Right.
Yeah, those who He loves, not to damage us, but
right
to draw out of us what He wants to use us for.
Right. And that's in the Hebrews chapter 12. He talks about exactly that. Let me just read it. It says here, And have you forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more rather be subjected to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best for them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. Therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight the path of your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather healed. Now, that's pretty straightforward as to what God does to us in our lives. He disciplines us for what purpose? To make us holy. Okay, like I said, imagine where God just gives us everything. We got everything. Are we going to be holy? Heck no, we're going to become ungrateful pigs, I guarantee it, because that's the way we are by nature, and it's only going to be brought out with this tremendous ingratitude. That's why God puts us through so many difficult things in life, to get us to appreciate even the most common things. I almost always, when I take a drink of water, thank God as I'm swallowing the water, I do. Because I've gone 3 days, 3 nights without water on more than one occasion. And I tell you right now, you know, you can really begin to appreciate a very simple, ordinary thing when you don't have it. You know what I mean? You can really, really appreciate it. Yeah.
Every form of pain, I think, and everything that does happen to us, even if it's meant for something bad, God does it for something good. Yeah. He'll use it for something good. And a lot of times, people who suffer, God is getting their attention for them. And, you know, as he says, life on this world is a fleeting blink anyway compared to eternity. And if somebody's pain or suffering can get them in tune with him for the benefit of eternity, you know, it's his mercy, really.
Yeah. Okay, I tell you what, let's wind this down here. I think we're running out of time. Anyway, he says... in verse 27, and Jesus went out along with his disciples to the village of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he questioned his disciples, saying to them, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, but still others one of the prophets." And he continued by questioning them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered and said to him, "Thou art the Christ." And he warned them all to tell no one about him, and he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he was stating the matter plainly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning around and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest but man's." And he summoned the multitude with his disciples and said to them, "If anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life shall lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's shall save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words and this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father and with his holy angels." Okay, just winding this down. I think we've gone over this when we went through other Gospels. But again, I think it's really, really, to me, at the very heart of everything that we believe is the person of Jesus Christ. You know, Jesus asked his disciples, and I believe this is around halfway through his ministry, and his disciples have been with him for some time now, and people still don't know exactly who he is. Even his disciples have, "Who is this guy, man?" When he calmed the sea and everything, he says, "Who is this guy?" Even the winds and the waves obey him. And they still didn't grasp who this guy is. And I'm telling you, man, everything hinges on the person of Jesus Christ. Everything hinges on the person of Jesus Christ. More than anything else, it's the person of Jesus Christ. You can't tell me whether he was a great moral, ethical teacher and so on and so forth. Because to me, if that's all he was, then he was the biggest con man, the biggest liar, the biggest deceiver that ever walked the face of this earth. Because he flat out claimed to be equal with God, to be God incarnate. That's what he claimed. All right? You know, that's not mincing around with words. So either he is or he isn't. There is no in between here. So when he says, who do men say that I am? It's so important that we understand that. Once we recognize that Jesus is God, then everything falls into place. And what I mean by that is when I got saved, it came out of this bar, and it really hit me between the eyes. I mean, really powerful, really hard, that Jesus is God. When that really hit me like a ton of bricks, the ultimate reality says this: okay, if he's God, what am I doing with my life? What does he want me to do in my life? You see, when Paul's on his road to Damascus, he got knocked off his high horse. He was asked the two most profound questions that you could ask in the universe. When Paul said this: who art thou, Lord, and what do you want me to do? You cannot ask any more profound questions. You can't. There is none. Now, if Jesus Christ is just a great moral ethical teacher, then it doesn't matter. Nothing matters. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But if he's God, then everything falls into place, and you can't ask a more profound question. Okay, he's God, then what does he want me to do? You know, you can't say, oh yeah, Jesus is God, and then go your merry way. Hey, wait a minute, come here, man. Hey, he's God. What does he want you to do? You know, and you better darn well do it because of who he is. Not because of what he taught, not because of what he said, not because of what he did, but because of who he is. You know what I'm saying? The whole thing. You know, you can't even say that the resurrection is more important because it isn't. Everything hinges upon who he is. That's it. Who is this guy? You know, and if you miss that, you missed the boat, period. You missed it for all eternity. We are told very plainly that, hey, there's coming a day when every knee shall bend and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord in heaven, on earth, and in hell, under the earth. And when we're dealing with the person of Jesus Christ, you're going to have to obey him. You're going to have to follow him, even at the expense of what? Your fleeting career. Because what did Jesus say in his last few verses? What does it profit a man if he gained the whole world and forfeits his soul? What is it going to profit a man if he gains the presidency and loses his soul? And what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? There's nothing. Nothing he can buy a soul for. Nothing. I don't care. The richest man in the world, you're not going to exchange that for your soul. And then he says very plainly, if whoever is ashamed of me and my words, in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be also ashamed of him. Last thing before we close. Three times in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus begins to teach his disciples that the Son of Man is going to have to be given over to death. He's going to have to put to death, and that in 3 days he's going to rise again. Now, right after Peter proclaims him as being the Son of God, Jesus talks about dying, and then Peter takes him aside. What are you talking about, man? This ain't going to happen to you. What did Jesus say? Get behind me, Satan. Now, he wasn't calling Peter Satan, but he knew that Satan was influencing his thought life. He's saying, these are the thoughts of men, not God. You see, the apostles, they wanted a conquering hero that was going to come in, put his heel on Rome's neck, and free Israel, and there was going to be this glorious kingdom ushered in. They wanted nothing to do with a Messiah who was going to be killed. You see what I'm saying? But these are men's thoughts. These aren't God's thoughts. See, this is the whole issue that Jesus was trying to get across here, is that, hey, we have to deal with the sin issue. That's the whole thing. We got to deal with this sin issue. His most important message was to get across the word, not to heal people, not to do miracles. But it seemed like the more miracles he would do, the more it would hinder his getting out the message that, hey, you need to repent. You need to change your life. And the message was being overshadowed by the deeds, by his miracles. That's why he was telling people, don't be telling people this. See what I'm saying? There was definitely a reasoning to what we consider madness. Anyway, the last comment. He says in that verse 34, he summoned the multitude with his disciples, saying to them, if anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. You know, that's it in a nutshell if we're going to follow Christ. What do we have to do? Deny ourselves. And that's a tough thing to do. It really is, because we have to make him number one in our life. Deny ourselves, pick up a cross daily. What is our cross? Symbolically, what is our cross?
Whatever burden, issue, concern.
Well, what our cross is primarily, okay? Sure, we have all kinds of different crosses in life, okay? But our cross, pick up our cross daily. Believe me, even if everything's going fine in your life, you've got perfect health and everything's going, you still have a cross. You know what your cross is? It's your fallen nature. Deny yourself, pick up your fallen nature every day and follow me. You see? Hey, I struggle with this nature every single day. I mean, I'm even in church today, you know, all by myself, down on my face, and oh God, you know, I just feel like such a sinful man. I just, you know, I'm so tired of the struggle, you know what I'm saying, of wanting God and my spirit, wanting to do His will, and just feeling this constant pull of the flesh and the world and the devil, you know what I'm saying? But I have to just deny myself, pick up my cross daily, follow Him. Peter, after Jesus performed the miracle of filling their boats with fish, Peter swam the shore and he goes running up to Jesus and he gets down on his knees and says, "Depart from me, O Lord, for I'm a sinful man." And I struggle with that every day. I feel like, God, I depart from me because I'm such a sinful man. And yet at the same token, I say, Lord, because I'm such a sinful man, I need to cling to you. It's a real dilemma. You know what I'm saying? This is what he means by pick up your cross daily, deny yourself, and follow me. That's what it takes. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You got to deny yourself. Yeah. Anybody have any want to add or share?